thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source.
It's just a real pleasure to welcome Bob Hoy back to the studio today, formerly of Institutional Advisors, now Charts and Markets. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, it's always good to be with you because you, and I'm sure you're representing your listeners as well, are a really good researcher yourself. This is what it's all based upon. If you're not doing research, you're moving on intuition. And I've always considered myself a lucky researcher. I've stumbled upon events, and then events were linked, and then those actually repeat. So in the 70s, I realized that, you know, they were talking about inflation and all the issues, and then so coming out was the, you know, the big bubble stuff. Because you had, they started talking about the South Sea Bubble of 1720. So I looked at that, and then I looked at 1929, and then I looked in 9 years before 1920. In 1920, there was a huge global speculation in commodities. I mean, in the U.S., it even drove the CPI inflation up to 22%. Whereas when it hit, 14 or 15 in 1980, this was an issue. So then I thought, well, let's look back. And indeed, the first great bubble, 1720, occurred 9 years after a major global peak in commodities, which was 1711. So then I looked and I thought, okay, now we knew the Kondratiev stuff about things happening 50 to 55 years apart. So I said, well, there's bound to be, and his work was on commodity peaks, inflation peaks and stuff like that. So I went looking, and I'd find a little mention of a financial problem in 1772. So I had a file, 1772, and it's about an inch and a half thick. And then you'd find a really obscure mention of a financial problem in England in 1618. So I formed a paper file, 1618, and it's more than an inch thick. So then what you had, and I went looking for, was recurring patterns. Big commodity peak, like 1920. And big stock peak 1929. So then if you look at the S&P now, and the Dow are making new highs, people are making noise about it, but these are indexes that financial institutions can buy. But if you take a look at the New York Stock Exchange Composite, it set a huge peak in January of 2018. And if you take a look at the world index of stocks without the U.S. in it, it set its peak in January of 2018. And that was your 9 years after the commodity peak in 2008. So this is matched up with history. And I think the extra excitement in S&P and Dow stocks is just straight institutional funds buying the most liquid stocks. And these now, this week, are getting a little overdone again. So the recurring patterns is amazing because no one wrote a book in 1720 on how to create a wild financial mania. And yet everyone since 1772, 1825, 1873, and 1929, and now possibly 2018, has followed that same pattern. So it's amazing. I think I'm going to write a story about this one. So here we are. Then the other thing you look for you nowadays with technical measures we have, you can measure the degree of speculation. There's two things. One is momentum. Well, actually, there's three. The other is a trading pattern that you get going into an important high. And then the other is like sentiment, the number of advisories that are bullish. And so these all add up. Then the other one we do, Chris, is evaluation. And this gets tricky because normal valuations are relative to earnings, the price-earnings ratio. And then when you've got the world wanting to buy stocks, the brokerage firms with their research department are, of course, eager to transact the business, because if they don't do it, somebody else will. So then the research department will come up on estimates of earnings that may be extravagant, but they do make the PE multiple attractive. So it rationalizes buying. But the one I like is where you take the S&P and divide it in by the average wage from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And it's very high, and it's been high for way more than a year. And I haven't got the numbers in front of me, but it's higher than it got at the wild.com bubble in 2000, and it's very much higher than reached with the cyclical peak in 2007. So you've got excessive valuations, you've had great momentum moves, you've had sentiment, and you've got pattern, all calling, all sort of saying that this is a major top in the stock market being built now. And we have to respect, this is clinical stuff, Chris. It's just telling us that. So then the other thing that is very easy to research is, again, on these great financial bubbles. And as they occurred in England, because it was the senior economy and the senior financial market before New York, that the peaks in the greatest bubbles in history were always in May or June, and then they turned around in the summertime, and all five previous great bubbles suffered a liquidity crisis in the fall of the year. And then the worst sort of in late-ish October, and then kind of some relief, and then the final test in each one was in November, where it kind of cleared the markets, and then you got the rebound. So this is, except for one, the huge 1825 bubble, that liquidity crisis went on right down until Christmas time of that year. And this is, of course, what we used last year, that if there was some selling pressures discovered in the fall, that it could clear as late as Christmas time. So we had a little technical work there. On I think it was December 26th, we sent it out, where both the S&P had generated downside capitulations and crude oil at the same time, December 26th. So that one cleared the market, and then, of course, then you go for the rebound. And here again, you use history. And when is the market likely to be best? Well, May, June. So we just sort of said second quarter. We would find an important top. And it's sort of building in here now. So our view now, Chris, is that we've had very good innings. The gains in the stock market at the four-month notch from the start of the year were the best on, who knows, decades. But you've got comfort things that go with a good move in the stock market, and that was action in the yield curve. It was being positive. The curve, of course, is the difference between long-dated bonds and short-dated stuff. And then you also have had very positive action in the credit spreads. And of course, that's the difference in risk between high-grade bonds and low-grade bonds. And when you're in a boom, there's a lot of confidence, so people will buy low-grade bonds. But the yield curve is now, let's call it beginning to change. It's had one step back, and the next step will be important. And then you also have the credit spreads, and it's had what we call the first breakout on a turn to possible widening. And right now, as we speak, it's very close to doing the second breakout. And then going back to 2007, the second breakout, I think, was in late July, maybe July 25th or something like that, just going off memory. So it gave a warning to the high in that stock market, which was the middle of October, of a number of months. It was comfortable. So we'll be letting our readers know about this second breakout on credit spread widening and the second stage of the yield curve turning. And I mention these two because if you look at all of the bull markets in history, they have turned and been alerted. The turn has been alerted by changes in the credit markets. And the other thing is that if the central banking, the Federal Reserve, really was working, they would prevent the changes in the yield curve, and they would prevent the changes in credit spreads that anticipates the reversal, but they can't do it. So, yes, they can lower interest rates at the short end, but then Mr. Market and Mother Nature take it from after that. They just do what they want, and the public does what it wants.
You know, you brought up a couple interesting points. This issue we're facing today, it really echoes throughout history. One of my early favorites, Fiat Money, Inflation in France by Dixon White, Extraordinary Popular Delusions, Madness of Crowds by Mackay. Only part of that book was on the financial markets. The rest, I think, was human psychology. And it really is a psychological phenomenon. I mean, people, they go mad in herds. They come back to their senses slowly.
Beautiful. They go mad in herds.
Yeah, they return to their senses one by one. And here we are today. What a jubilee we've had for the last, especially 40, 50 years, I think you'd agree. The percentage of those who have enjoyed the jubilee in the last few years, I think you'd agree, has collapsed. The middle class used to, about 20, 30 years ago, the inception, we're all lured, aren't we? We take the bait, and then the trap, you know, snaps shut.
Now, we got the guidance there, and right now I'd be selling the rallies, building your own personal liquidity, because this is the feature of a post-bubble condition, is that liquidity absolutely vanishes. There's no money around. There's no money around for anything. And here's the irony, is that the Federal Reserve was set up to, well, in 1900, most experienced people in banking knew that a financial setback was followed by a recession. So they came up with the idea, okay, we'll have the Federal Reserve System, and it will be a lender of last resort, and it will prevent financial setbacks. Therefore, there'll be no recessions. And this, of course, was all renewed in the 1960s with Paul Samuelson, who was one of the key guys in macroeconomics, where then the economists began to get mainframe computers, and then they could do programs and models on the economy. And then I know that was a buzz because I came into the business in the mid-60s. And in 1965, 66, pretty good bull market. And things getting a little stressed. And, oh, no, the word was, no, there won't be any recessions. So, but if you just take a look at the National Bureau of Economic Research, they're the outfit that declares officially recessions and expansions. And there's been 18 recessions since the Fed started in 1913. And concept used to get Fed through was that it would prevent recession. So it's an obvious failure. And what I think is that the next recession, and there will be one when you've had a boom like this, it's inevitable. And at this point, the folks, as part of the popular uprising, will look at the trillions of dollars of tax money that were thrown into the markets to prevent bad things from happening. And, of course, it never works. But this is what you were saying, is that fewer and fewer of the middle class are actually benefiting from all of the boom stuff. And it's actually only financial adventurers and traders and whatnot who can take advantage of it. And this is where you have the extraordinary number of billionaires who have made, actually in the classical sense of the word, fabulous amounts of wealth out of paper, very high-priced stocks. So the popular uprising is attempting to take the process of government out of experts' hands and put it back into we the people. And then also part of this would be is the funding of intrusive government, which, as you mentioned earlier in the show, that they were pushing taxation to the limits, take so much taxation out of the system. So then the rest of the ambition is satisfied by the central bank printing money. So you the notion that the central bank can manage the economy is not been proven. But that it continues is because it is providing unlimited funding to another experiment in unlimited government. And the whole point of the U.S. written constitution was to prevent experiments in unlimited government, and it hasn't been successful. But then, on the other hand, the British parliamentary tradition with an unwritten constitution, but a system that was supposed to be bulletproof against ambitious government, the ambition got around that system of limited government as well. So we live in extraordinary times. So, and the last long experiment in authoritarian government began in about 1500 and corrupted everything in society and ran its limit in the early 1600s, and the Reformation is best followed in England, and it's just ordinary folk had enough of it and began to resist. And one thing that our listeners should look up, and it's in the Wikipedia, is England's, and it's called the Glorious Revolution, in quotation marks, of 1688, and you can read that, and it was essentially a popular uprising against the last absolutist king, and he even threatened to bring troops over from France to impose his order in England, but he didn't have the politics behind him. Essentially, this prosperity businessman in London really made the thing go, but it had widespread popular support in the country, and then the last absolutist king looked at the way the wind was blowing and realized that he was on the losing side. So he went over the last authoritarian king moved over and found comfort in authoritarian France. But as I say, our listeners should Google it in the Wikipedia. It's just quite simply Glorious Revolution, and it's very much similar. So, Chris, while I'm watching for these excesses in the financial markets to run their course the next month or so, we're looking for then the possible discovery of a liquidity problem in the fall. And this then would be an important step. Now, this is kind of pessimistic, but on the optimistic side, if the public can see that this great intrusion by the central banks not working, then you're in a condition whereby the whole of the financial side can be reformed, and it would go along with a movement to reform unlimited government. So on the longer term, I'm one of the optimists on the political course of history, that it will, this popular uprising will be successful, and it will eventually be called a great reformation. So, hey, there's financial risks ahead, but then ultimately for ordinary folk, there'll be a political reform, and I'm looking forward to it.
Speaking of, you know, potential for unexpected occurrences, you know, we've had the bulk of our guests here for a decade calling for the end of U.S. equities, 500-600 weeks in a row almost. I mean, one of the longest and spectacular, most spectacular bull markets. Of course, if you really look at it from the former peak of the year 2000 or 2008, maybe it's not that big of a bull market rally. But while we try to pontificate on why a market top is in, why it should roll over, why we think it's going to, why not just look at the primary theme and trend? You know, we've just made a new high in the past few months. There's no reason to assume we won't make further highs. I mean, that is the tendency.
From September 1929, that everybody learned to buy the dips. And then there's always the last dip that doesn't work. So this is where our technical research comes in, that we've got the momentum, we've got the sentiment, and we're getting patterns that suggest this is topping. So then what you need to see is a real break in momentum, and then indexes taking out the previous dip. And then you look at the seasonals. Hey, when's it probable? After August. So, but yeah, this is going to trade around in here now. But again, every one of these great financial booms. And also consider, Chris, that for participants, even though as early as 1720, it was the biggest financial boom in history. And each one since has been the biggest and most compelling financial boom in history. So no one, even with the senior central bank, there was no real move made to bring the speculation to an end. It just ends typically in the summer, and then you have a liquidity problem in the fall. So that's what we're resting on, and it's just quite simple. You've got strong bids now. It's time to be lightening up on stocks. Also, you would be market for low-grade securities, junk, etc., has been very good, and it'd be lightening up on that, getting rid of risk. Now, also in the corporate market, the corporate bond market, the high-grade corporate bond market, the action has been fantastic. Corporations have been doing new issues as fast as they can because the market wants it. But the rush in prices for high-grade bonds, corporates, the symbol is LQD. It's given a couple of weeks ago all our technical bells and whistles. It's got upside exhaustion, which is momentum, and it's got a sequential sell, which is a pattern. And we had, a week before that, we had the same action in long treasuries, the bond future. And both are rolling over. So, again, this is an important thing because they've been calling this the everything bubble. And this goes back to October 2017 when we did a piece, and the conclusion was that everything would get bubbled, including even the Dow. And this is when a widely followed financial advisor was saying that the Dow would go up to 40,000 because there were no alternatives, that all that money created would have to flow into the New York Stock Exchange because everything else would be, there'd be no alternatives. But then we ended up indeed with the, as they're now calling it for the last year and a half, the everything bubble. And part of the everything bubble has been the incredible action in the bond future, and then more recently in high-grade bonds, and these are rolling over. So the everything bubble is beginning to lose participants, and at an interesting time. So, yeah, I'm quite confident that we have, let's call it this way, let's come up with a metaphor, Chris, that sunshine would prevail until around mid-year, and then August would see the sunshine turn to twilight, and then after August we go into the twilight zone. You remember the Rod Serling series on TV from years ago? It was really scary stories and a scary theme. So, yeah, and we've had the sunshine, and it looks like things are setting up to turn to twilight.
So you're not a big believer then that we're likely to continue in this remarkable breakout that we've seen in U.S. equities. That's
The measures are there. We've got the readings. Now, there's also, you were wondering about places to go. Now, I mentioned the high-grade bond market, which has been fabulous. Now, when it gets this far, you want to shorten term and reduce risk. So our ideal position would be 3 to 4 year high-grade U.S. corporate bonds. Another good position, it's yet to come. In each of the post-bubble contractions in the past, and profitability has flowed back into the gold mining, and you've had the greatest bull markets in history for gold have occurred during post-bubble contractions. But the problem is that if we do have a sell-off in the fall in the big market, it's going to take the gold stocks down with it. And gold is actually acting well. It also is building a base on its real price as adjusted by the consumer price index. So, and this is what we watch for the longer term. Gold's real price going up will set up the next big bull market in gold. We've been positioned in this rally. It was November 1st when our technical said, yeah, let's buy on weakness. And the next low was in the middle of November. And it's been a good rally. And getting gold stocks are getting a little overdone here now. Now the street is getting revved up about silver, and of course, I've been in the business for a long time, and there's never been a year when there hasn't been a shortage of silver.
You know, we hit 95 on the gold to silver ratio. I mean, wow! Even if you're not a believer in the silver story, I mean, could there be a better time to maybe diversify a gold holding a bit, even just a third or a quarter, into silver and think of the relative value? I mean, it's an incredible...
The the thing about the gold-silver ratio is that in every post-bubble contraction, the gold-silver ratio goes up, where silver underperforms gold, and the ratio going up here now is actually one of our indicators on a pending financial contraction. Say we get into September and you get a day where suddenly silver's down a whole bunch against gold, and that is often precedes a liquidity problem in stocks and bonds. So the gold-silver ratio going up now is telling us that there are financial problems ahead. And a few weeks ago, I mean, the GSR got ahead of itself, but what we would look for here now is volatility in the GSR, and then in September, the next leg up in the gold-silver ratio seems probable, where suddenly silver, as I say, in previous financial distress, silver gets marked down relative to gold seriously. As a matter of fact, Chris, it's so reliable, it's an indicator. So for us, the gold-silver ratio going up is the equivalent. Well, I've called the gold-silver ratio the metallic credit spread. So it's like credit spreads, which have been widening for the last month, high-grade, low-grade bonds. And the gold-silver ratio has been rising. So those will go together. So, but to say now that, and also on these metals, you can make more money out of playing the stocks, like gold stocks or silver stocks, rather than the metals themselves. And it's the investment way to do it. And but that's ahead of us. There's going to be a very lengthy bull market for gold, and we're looking forward to it. The rally since last fall has been a good one, and some of the gold stocks we follow are getting a little overbought.
Well, you know, that's good news, right? Music to the ears of our precious metals aficionados to hear we will have a lengthy bull market. And, you know, you're really echoing, I think, the thoughts of a lot of our top guests here. And, of course, the hopes and aspirations of a lot of people who are frustrated, I think, with a lot of the
The gold sector, precious metals, been in a bear market since 2011. But in 2011, you had the gold-silver ratio way down. As a matter of fact, we flip it when we do the silver-gold ratio. And of course, in any bull market for both metals, silver will outperform. And when the RSI, which is a momentum indicator, gets above 80, the speculation is good. And in, I think it was April or May of 2011, that RSI got up to 92. We were monitoring at the time, and we knew that the only other time that RSI got up to 92 was in January 1980, when silver was up to $48. So, and we also had in 2011 an indicator that I haven't talked about. It's our momentum peak forecaster, and it gave a huge sell signal on the hot items, which were then base metals and precious metals. So we had two things going for us at that peak. But now what we're looking for is that when I'm talking about a bull market based upon gold, gold's real price going up, that's post-bubble deflation. And you do not need to have gold going up in U.S. dollar terms. As a matter of fact, it's quite likely that the U.S. dollar will be chronically firm relative to most currencies and most commodities. And Chris, you might wonder why I come up with that one, and that's what's happened with the senior currency in all five previous post-bubble contractions. The senior currency just becomes, as I say, chronically strong, against most currencies and most commodities for most of the time. It's the feature of a post-bubble deflation. But ironically, Mother Nature sets it up so that you have a bull market in gold, real price in gold stocks, because in a financial mania, you have a huge expansion of, let's call them normal instruments of credit. And then also you have the fanciful instruments of credit, like CDOs and all sorts of invented stuff. And in the bust, these things go into a vacuum. And so what happens is, as the real price of gold goes up, producers mine more gold. Gold goes in the banking system and begins to provide a liquidity, a real liquidity, when all of the normal instruments of credit are contracting and the fanciful instruments of credit just disappear, leaving, as I said, a credit vacuum. And Mother Nature fills vacuums, and she does it in the financial markets by having gold's real price go up. So, and it's not just the miners. Sure, they're making more money, but say you're an exploration company and you have a gold deposit, and it doesn't have to be in production. Maybe price of gold, it's not. But when you get the real price going up, it also enhances the valuation of a exploration property. So the whole of the gold side, from producers to exploration bets, will do very well.
Very good. All right, Bob Hoy, we just can't thank you enough. Would you like to tell people more about the services you provide?
Yeah, we publish weekly a good survey of all of the key items in the financial markets, and then our technical work comes out on opportunities where, hey, here's a trade, long or short, let's go. So we actually do have an enjoyable time. Good, Chris, and look forward to talking to you next time.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver medals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by TradeWind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals distributed ledger and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit,
with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Mini Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Mini Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Mini Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Mini Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange and in the US, MENEF. Remember to sign up to Mini's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Mini Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.